Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan.
And we're here to talk about old school gaming. And Dan and I agreed that perhaps the first thing we should try to do is define what old school is.
You gotta start with the definitions.
Definitions, yeah, there you go.
That's how you gotta start, yeah.
So I think it's actually pretty difficult to define old school. It's like defining organic, right? It's
Yeah, I have no idea how anyone's ever gonna define that.
Right. What is old school? I know it when I see it, but, well, is it old? Is it necessarily even old? Let's start there. Is stuff that is being produced in the OSR qualify?
Great. Sure. I mean, clearly people are trying to, conjure, the feeling that, of games, from prior ages. So I think that, So Paul, obviously there's the, you know, in gaming, OSR stands for old school renaissance.
Yep.
Right? Yeah.
I've heard other alternates for the R, revival or...
Right. There you go. Okay. So do you feel that the games that you run qualify as OSR?
That is very interesting. I think that the D&D games I run for sure. I think they do.
Yeah.
For those who don't know... So I run some OD&D. When I started going back to old school, I started with basic D&D, BX Moldvay, for those who know that.
Which is a great, great rule set.
Yep. So I did that. I did some Labyrinth Lord, which of course is a retro clone of that same edition. But eventually, after lots of chats with Dan, I converted back to OD&D, the original white box book. And now I use Dan's set of house rules on top of that, which is called the Original Edition Delta, or OED. Go check it out at oedgames.com. There you go. Free plug for you, Dan.
Thank you. Yes.
There you go.
A couple
go right in front of your face for them to see it.
Well cracked, well used, well worn.
Excellent. But, I mean, the very fact that there are alterations, right? Like you abolished clerics. That's huge. Everybody loves to talk about there's no clerics in OED.
Right.
Yes, that is decidedly OSR, I think.
Yeah. I certainly feel like there's no, however you slice it up, if you look at the original D&D books, I mean, there's gaps, there's lacuna, there's some contradictions in there, and so in order to play, you've got to make at least some interpretations or fill-ins, and then that kind of winds up unleashing, like, how far do you go with it? And usually my instinct is to stay as close to it as I can, but as soon as you start making changes, that's clearly got to be part of the process of interfacing with original D&D. And it's funny because I compare it to, very ancient religious texts when there are things that are clearly don't make sense. And it's weird that those missing gaps are precisely the thing that has made people spend a lot of time interpreting and analyzing it. And maybe if it had actually been perfect and well-defined in the first place, it wouldn't have had the legs to get people to think about it so much. Personally, I wish that there was... Part of me wishes that the rules were just, like, perfect to begin with, and then part of me is like, maybe that was just... It would have just died if that had been the case.
Yeah, so to get back to the topic here, is when you run OED, is that old school gaming?
I hope so. I want it to be, and that's the intent. And if somebody else came and had been gaming prior to me and disagree, and, you know, some people do disagree with it, right? So some things that I point out in some online discussion boards, people who are older than I am say that it's not classic D&D, but it's certainly the intent. I would say, I hope it is.
Well, I think you made a good point there of it being there being a lot of gaps and requiring a lot of interpretation, yeah. which is honestly something I love about old school games, right? That oftentimes right. they have that. That's almost, right. to me, a feature of old school games is that right. a lot is undefined and left to interpretation of right. the DM.
Right.
This right. that even, I think, bridges into Matt Finch's definition. If you look at Matt Finch's primer for old school games, his first major point is rulings, not rules. Right? That, right, that nature of the DM at the table to make stuff up on the fly and not feel right. Beholden to a set of written rules necessarily.
Right. So obviously that bears on the email that you and I both got I guess in October by William Heilman, right? William Heilman, who that was one of the excellent questions that he asked about the rulings not rules dictum. And I actually wouldn't, it's interesting because I wouldn't have been able to say that it had been from Matt Finch actually. When I emailed him back, and I didn't CC you on this, but I actually said, this is one of the things that I'm kind of an iconoclast about, in old school gaming is when people say something like the rules don't matter, personally, I actually disagree with that. And I feel the rules do matter. And they do make a difference, and I certainly want them to be concise and short and memorable, and something you don't need to look up. So I certainly agree that you like look taking a book and riffling through it for a rule is deadly in the game. Yep. So I do want concise, solid rules that I can remember and not have to look up. But I do feel that the rules matter.
That concise writing, honestly, is what I love so much about the stuff you've produced for OED. Honestly,
great.
The very brief player guide. Right. The Book of Spells. Honestly, this is the whole reason I get asked sometimes, like, oh, do you follow Dan's lead of no clerics? And I do, right. which is not to say I hate clerics. In right. fact, I would put them back in if you would bother to write a Book of Spells for clerics, but I know you're not going to do that.
Great,
so
yes.
No clerics is my answer.
Great, great. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, when I play, like half the time I take the cleric when I'm personally the player, which everybody always like jumps out of their seat and go, but I thought you hated clerics. And, you know, I don't like, hey, that's got to be a different video, right?
Right, we have to do a whole separate stream on clerics.
We have to have a different video.
Specifically that, about clerics again. Let's talk about right. what is old school.
Right.
We clearly agree that OED games is old school.
Yeah.
I guess what do you think pushes the boundaries of old school? Can you think of any examples of where you're like, I'm not sure that that's old school?
Okay. Well, let me poke at. So having thought about this before, let me poke at my non-dogmatic attempt at scoping out what old school is. So when this question was first posed, I think four things popped into my mind about what is old school, like at least D&D. And what was my first one? Is it, like we were just saying, things tend to be pretty small and brief in their writing. The rules are fairly short. The character descriptions are fairly short. The adventure locales are fairly brief in how they're written.
Isn't that, though, more OSR than old school? Like, I'm thinking now of, like, if I cracked open Keep on the Borderlands right now, it's hard
yeah.
to say that Gary Gygax was brief in his descriptions.
Well, okay. So if you go to this, there is this fairly well shared photo, maybe about 10 years ago, of him running what people believe to be the original
yep.
Castle Greyhawk, right?
Yep.
And he's got a loose leaf binder, which interestingly is a piece of required equipment in the OD&D published rules. Actually, you've got to have a loose leaf binder is one of the things. So he's got a loose leaf binder. He's got one page of a graph paper, and he's got one page of entry listings where all the entry listings are just one line each.
Yep.
So
I've seen that photo, and if there's such yeah. a thing as show notes, we will put a link.
Yes. Good. Great. Good point. And so I do feel like there was a fairly rapid evolution, like over about 10 years from that to, if you see the original tournament, Lost Caverns of Sajkanth, mm-hmm. right? Like a whole level is, I think, sitting on one standard piece of paper.
Yep.
And then I think that people felt that for published material that had to be more developed. And so, you know, B2 is a little bit longer. You know, the Tomb of Horrors is a little bit longer. when you get up to 1984 and you have the Temple of Elemental Evil, that stuff is, and of course that was really Frank Mentzer that finished that, but man, that stuff is huge. That stuff is like a whole page per area.
Right. Certainly, my preference to go to run stuff from shorter descriptions.
Yeah.
I love OSR stuff that apes that style. Yeah. With when I'm looking at things like One Page Dungeon Contest or, say Michael Curtis's Stone Hell. Right, everything's in that format where it's super tight and brief and whatnot. I think there's an extreme. If we look back, or like way back, and I think undoubtedly old school is Palace of the Vampire Queen. That thing is so brief as to I'm not sure what the hell to do with it.
Right.
So is being brief simply an indicator of old school, or is it a requirement?
I don't think anything's a requirement.
Temple of Elemental Evil, is that old school?
Ish. So I'm not going to say that anything's a hard requirement.
Yep.
And I'm going to say that everything's on a continuum. And I do think that looking at Temple of Elemental Evil, that's walking in the other direction. And those room descriptions are huge to the point of being really hard to use. And I even say, even the sample dungeon in the Dungeon Master's Guide in 79, even those room descriptions are distressingly large to me. So I even look at the DM's guide and go, that's walking away in the wrong direction, surprisingly.
Okay, so old school includes briefness to allow interpretation at the table. That's possibly a property of old school.
Yeah, and on that point, you know, so in the stuff that I personally write, the dungeons that I write, like I had, like up until about a year or six months ago, I was writing things maybe on the scope of B2 or the Dungeon Master's Guide. And, you know, I hadn't actually been running a campaign for many years. Fortunately, this year, I actually have had a regular campaign. And I realized that those descriptions were actually getting in my way at the table.
Yeah.
And so in the last couple of months, I actually have started to cut it down to be focused on cutting it down a little bit more, because a couple times I had glitches at the table because I couldn't find stuff.
Yeah, that's certainly why I prefer those shorter styles, right? It's something that I can glance down at and read and incorporate into the game very quickly without having to spend a bunch of time.
I think I resisted that and probably argued with you in the past, and I'm coming closer to that myself lately.
I was discussing the rulings not rules mantra with someone recently, and pointed out that like, if I'm at the table and I pick up a book and I start flipping through it, I find myself quickly mumbling to myself, make it up, make it up, make it up. And then it takes about three times for me to go, oh, right, right. And I put the book down and I make it up.
Brief. Is that a D&D type thing, or is that like other games with larger books?
I think any game. At this point, that's just my style of GMing, I think, is that any game I'm running, if I'm at the point where I've got a book open and I'm reading, then guaranteed everyone else at the table is bored.
Right? Yeah, so, I agree. I think I'm at the point where I don't bring books.
Yeah.
I mean, or I, you know, this is about the best gift I ever got when Paul here bound original D&D in a custom book. So I bring this to my games. I don't plan on ever opening it.
Yeah.
So I leave it behind me. I don't actually have it on the table. And my expectation.
Yeah. I have a version of that I made for myself, and I put that sort of biblical, you know, colored ribbons. You know, you see it every.
Right.
So I have colored ribbons at 12 places to the important page that I care about. And I've started to even memorize the colors. Oh, red is monsters. Great.
Yeah. There. Yeah. Great. Great. That's how it ought to be. But I usually leave it about 6 feet behind me, and I don't actually expect to ever pick it up except for unusual cases.
Okay. I think we've beaten this one to death. I want to talk about another aspect that came up recently. Yeah. Someone pointed out to me this great podcast called Fear of a Black Dragon. Now, I've only listened to one episode. It was a fantastic episode. Definitely recommend it. And in that podcast, the two hosts tried to describe what is old school, or specifically they were looking for what is an old school module, what indicates old school module writing. And what they came up with was there is no ending. Like, explicitly, in terms of story arc, ending is not included in the written text. Beginning, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe some middle, And I find this to be true, honestly, when I'm looking at a lot of things. Again, we're picking on Keep on the Borderlands, so let's talk about that.
Right.
I see a lot of locations. I see a lot of descriptions of characters who are there and what their motivations are. Right. I don't see anything that indicates what's going to happen to the party or what the final outcome of when the adventure is over, XYZ will be true. I don't think you see that in the text anywhere.
Right. It's an interesting take on it. I would be about 60 degrees off from that. So I think this was my second bullet point when I wrote was, I would describe that as places, not plots.
Mm-hmm.
So you see locations, and I don't think that's surprising because of the emphasis on the mega dungeon environment was the initial emphasis. So I 95% of your publication is going to be a bunch of places. It's not going to be, and the places tend to be static until the players get there, and you tend not you do have maybe like half a page of like, here's the situation and here's why bad people are here, and you really don't see a whole lot of even NPCs with here's their plans, here's what they're going to do.
I think that is generally true. Let's see, I can certainly come up with some counterexamples, right? L2. Certainly has a lot of like.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's his name? Lakovka, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's. I mean, yeah, so L2 is very plot driven, right?
Yeah.
So, and I mean, personally, I feel like so when so and that's the name of that is Assassin's Knot.
Yep.
Is I feel like that was considered semi revolutionary at the time.
Okay.
So obviously L1. Is primarily, it's a wilderness and a dungeon, and when L2 came out, I feel like there was a bit of a splash of like, oh, this is a very different way of writing D&D adventures.
You make a good point, and certainly, like, I absolutely adore L1, and I've never used L2. But, let's see, sorry, I'm trying to keep my frame of mind and stuff that I know we've both read. I don't know if you've read, for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay First Edition, Shadows Over Bogenhoffen. I think you
have
played in that together.
Yeah.
Many, many, many years ago.
Right.
But that's also written in that similar style of what I would say is a lot of plot, right? Here's a lot of characters and what their motivations are and what they'd like to do.
Yeah.
Now, what's definitely missing, though, is what the expected outcome is once the players interact with them. And they even go through contortions in the writing to say, well, they might do this, they might do that, they might do this other thing. But GM, really, you have to prepare yourself because anything could happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel that that's part. I feel the no ending is part of it.
Yeah.
I feel that there's also pretty close to no middle and almost no beginning either. I feel like there's not even any beginning. Like I think it because I think that like if you look at Tomb of Horrors, right? I think at the very first, like the second publication. Has a 5-bullet-point list of, I think, reasons why you might want to go there. And I don't think the first publication had that. So I think as time went on, this bit about even having initial hooks something that added.
You make a good point, I think, there of, like, one of the interesting things about any role-playing game is, especially ones written for, not for convention play, but for home campaign play, is that we can make really very few assumptions about the players. So it's very difficult to say, why would the players care? Why would they come here?
Right. And I also, so my thesis on that is that that's the easy part.
Mm.
I feel like if you give me a place and a setting and it's strategically interesting, like and the statistics are reasonable, like I feel like that's the hard part. And I feel like if you give me that, it's really easy to come up with reasons why you would want to go here or reasons why your particular character would want to go here. And I've always found the ongoing story part pretty easy to add to it once you have a well-written location.
So there's an interesting contradiction here, I think, that I want to bring up. Much as you sort of said you really rebel against the rules not being important, likewise, I would say there is no plot is totally inaccurate. There's lots of plot, but the plot isn't in the text. The plot comes through play.
All right. Well, that was a better argument than I was expecting there.
Right. Well, you just mentioned that the elements of the story, right? There are clearly elements of the story in the game. They happen. But I think that the thing for me that really marks old school is that they're not pre-written. They're not necessarily preordained in the text, and that I'm expected as DM to take what the player's motivations are, take what the locations and the events that the text is telling me are going to happen or exist, shall we say. Simply, these locations, things exist, and assemble that all together into some kind of story.
Right. And I will say there's more than just there are other issues that are important in gaming that aren't in the published text. For example, I remember, I think it was Peter Abigatson writing like around 2000 that they had stripped out any comic material in their publications. Is it previously, like in Dungeon Magazine, a lot of writers were trying to put in these comic scenes, and it really didn't work or interface the table well. And I think Atkinson was walking around at a gaming convention, and you know, most tables are laughing most of the time, right? And they're gonna bring in their own comic elements without it actually being in the published text.
That's
I agree with that, right? My games are laughing all the time, but in my published materials, or at least my prepared materials, it's mostly a bunch of really awful stuff. And so I agree with you that the publication can be a bunch of places and locations, and then you can knit it to, you can crochet it together in an ongoing campaign to your taste, and that being a large part of your experience without it being part of the publication.
It's interesting.
It's true.
I'm trying to think of cases that might countermand that, but I certainly have some written material that is humorous, but I feel like it's not trying to dictate the humor. It's just presenting potentially something that is ridiculous that inevitably the players will make fun of.
Well, one of the worst, it's interesting, you're running some paranoia games these days, and one of the worst experiences I ever had was running the paranoia game Red Clearance Black Box Blues or something like that, or Yellow Clearance Black Box Blues, right? And I think it won an award, and it had an award-winning writer. And the problem was the players get poisoned and then start spastically out of control dancing, right? And when I read the adventure, it was like, oh, this is hilarious, this is so funny. But nowadays I didn't have the language, but nowadays you'd say it totally takes away the player agency.
Yep.
So here I am for 20 minutes attempting to amuse the players by saying, here are your out of control actions. And so that was clearly a pre-written, scripted comedy scene. It was one of the worst, dumbest game sessions I've ever had. So I'm very sensitive to that particular issue.
The interesting thing is that the Paranoia games I've run recently use the latest Kickstarter edition, which is strongly improvisational. And in fact, the writing is incredibly brief. And the gameplay is impacted by a lot of random elements, random cards drawn here and there. So I think they've really... That edition, at least, has really shifted away from exactly what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, that was a long time ago, and I think that was either their very first or second adventure, but clearly more than one person took that lesson to heart, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And good. Yeah.
All right. So do you have any further elements there you want to bring up of things that are decidedly old school?
High death count. Very, very high death count, right? So, you know, like there's an old dragon issue where somebody kept count of all the deaths in their campaign, and it's like 500 deaths over 5 years or something like that.
Yep.
And that shows up in the DCC game, which they call it the funnel, where you're actually going to make, in kind of a paranoia style, this is a segue, we're pretty good at this.
Yeah.
In paranoia style, you're going to make five characters to begin with, and you're going to assume that four of them die. And so, you know, I think that initially, as actual old school games evolved from wargaming, there was, you know, we have some personalization of these characters, but life is fairly cheap, and you probably came out of a squad of 10 people, and they are game pieces, like, you know, a couple steps away from checkers or chess. The main thing that's going to happen is you attempt to kill somebody and you're killed instead. And so in real, so like in V2, most of the NPCs don't have names, right? They're really, really short, curt. If there's any backstory at all, they're just like fighter third level. They don't even have names. My understanding is a lot of people played the PCs didn't even have names, until maybe someday you got one to second level, and you're probably expecting to have a really high body count.
Interesting.
And it's going to be fairly rare for someone to survive and level up.
I think
that's clearly something that you don't see nowadays. When nowadays you expect to spend a lot of time on character generation, with new games, you expect them to survive and have a story, have an ongoing plot. And if somebody dies before their personal story is complete, a lot of people consider that to be anathema nowadays.
It's certainly how I run my D&D games, very deadly. And I have had moments with players who are more used to new school games being taken aback and needing an adjustment of, really, I can die this easily? Well, why do I care about this character? And the answer is, you don't. Maybe get attached to them after they've lived through a few things.
Exactly.
At the beginning, relax. you might need a couple burner characters before you find the one.
And Max had the exact same experience when he was running for new people about a year ago. He was in B2, and they, to my understanding, they wandered into the lizard man lair, right?
Yeah.
And apparently the fighters all said, we don't want to go in there, and the magic users said, yes, we want to go in there, and obviously the magic users all got annihilated.
Yep.
And in their first game session, they were very surprised that that was a possibility.
Yeah.
And Max was like, you gotta think about finding ways to avoid that, because that's kind of the default.
I have a dozen conflicting thoughts here. Let me just quickly list some out. So I think that I really want to spend some time thinking about that in comparison to games that are old school but not necessarily D&D. That's very interesting, although the only one coming into my brain right now is Cthulhu. And, of course, in my Cthulhu games, my explicit aim is to kill as many of the characters by the end of the session as possible.
Right,
so, check there.
And for, I was mostly a TSR junkie at one point. So if I think of Boot Hill, you had one page of character generation, you were dead in a session, quite likely.
Right. I think there's a certain practice, I think, that is fairly common in role-playing games that I used to partake in, and it's you that broke me of it, which is the backstory, right? It's creating backstory for the character prior to even the first session. When I was in college, that was very common practice. We would, you would sit down with the GM, you would talk about your character, you'd write a couple paragraphs about your character, GM has, the idea was supposed to be that the GM has all this grist to work with now, and they can create this wonderful story that incorporates all these backstories.
Right.
Now, the fact is that that's almost completely impossible, and inevitably the game at best becomes about one or two characters, and the others are sort of left holding the bag.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what about me?
Great point.
And then I remember playing with you and realizing at some point, I don't remember if it was because you explicitly stated it or it's just because of the way you were playing, that you came with nothing, and then as events happened in the game, you incorporated those into your character. So rather you let the game build the character than the character build the game.
Right.
Is that...
I feel is really old school. I feel like the writing the backgrounds to me is very new schooly.
Yeah.
People older than I am look at that kind of thing and they get really upset. They get really upset at the writing backstory bit because real old school D&Ders, they didn't even give a name. They thought giving a name was more effort than it was worth.
Cool. So this leads us into, I think, a next point of rules light, right? Because life is so cheap and the game is going to create my character for me, that it's going to be super easy for me to make a new character. And the things on the piece of paper when I'm done character creation should be really short.
Right. Well, I was unexpectedly really happy about when I started this campaign with my OED rules this year, is I had new players. They had not played classic D&D. They're wonderful players. They're mostly a bunch of improv comedians here in Brooklyn. Is I gave them my one sheet character generation rules. We made up characters together, and then in the first session, they walked into the first encounter, and two of them just immediately died to some berserkers. And I said, so if you can, whenever you can make up a new character, you can get back in the action. And I didn't think that I had taught them well enough to remember it, but they immediately sat down and they were very incented to make up a new character as quickly as possible to actually get in that same fight. So and I think it was maybe about two rounds, and they were like rolling dice. They were reading my house rules furiously, right? And they were making up, they were buying equipment, right? And it was two rounds later, and they ran into that fight, right? And actually saved the rest of the party by someone running in with a battle axe and, you know, chopping down one of the berserkers without me interacting with them at all.
Yeah.
And I actually wouldn't have guessed in advance if that was possible, but I have really smart players at the moment. And they actually made it up in within two rounds of the actual action, got back into that fight, which I was really happy about.
I had some interesting player behavior come out of this myself recently, where I had my players, when they realized sort of, and they're a group that is a little new to this, but they've played, you know, they just played continuously, right? They played first edition and then they played second and et cetera, et cetera. And so they've moved into new school without necessarily noticing it. So they realized that life is cheap, and they started rolling up new characters. And then they decided, well, we're going to hire a bunch of mercenaries to like guard our stuff while we're going from dungeon to dungeon. Yeah. And explicitly, this will be our pool for new characters that we will pull. Right. That way, we don't have to worry about like, where did you come from? Like, well, obviously, you were just one of the mercenaries, and you heard we shouts for help, and you came running in.
Yeah. So, and they're still doing that. Yes. Okay. Yeah. It's interesting because in my game, they've actually kind of held the hirelings at arm's length. They got two, and one player in particular is really unhappy about the money that's going to them, mm-hmm. and so that player's kind of taken the lead and kept most of the rest of the party away from that. Mm-hmm. So I actually kind of wish that they. Anyway, they do what they want, right? So yep. my party's gone in a very different direction though on that, actually.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So we are definitely starting to run a little long, but I think we should talk a little bit about the flip side, which is, you know, what breaks those rules? Is there stuff that's old school that doesn't fit any of the things we've talked about, or is there stuff that's new school that has those things and yet still doesn't manage quite to be old school?
That's interesting. Do you have examples in mind?
Nope. I'm just being a jerk and trying to fill out the brain space here. I mean, certainly there's like let's, you know, we could poke a little more fun at L2, right? Is L2 old school?
Yeah.
There you go. So
when that came out, it was clearly a sea change in like a way of writing adventures, and that was clearly what. A mystery plot, and you know, for some people that was like, oh, maybe adventures always should have been like this, and this is the future of adventure writing. But I feel is very, very much a big sea change in adventure writing, is that doesn't look anything like what came before it.
Yep. What about, say, a module like Ravenloft?
No.
You think it's not? That's interesting. So I've heard a lot of people pointed as like being very old school. And the reason for that is, despite the fact that it's got a lot of plot built in, and despite the fact that it's very, you know, highly story driven, that the story has also got a lot of random elements. That there's this whole big chart in the beginning of the soothsayer or whatever she is, the fortune teller.
That's the one thing that's going to save it, right? I agree. That's the one thing that's going to save it, is the plot is there's a plot and it's randomized. That's a fair argument.
How key to old school is randomization?
The 3D isometric dungeon design, that is just out as soon as you see that.
The art style kills it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the geography style.
Yeah. So randomization, like lots of charts, is that necessarily old school?
I don't know. What do you think?
I think it is a hallmark. I think it can be done well, and it can be done poorly.
Yeah.
My favorite charts, honestly, are the ones that are not specific to content, but rather are add-ons. For example, we talked about the whole, like, no beginning, right? I don't know what your characters are, so whatever.
Yeah.
The one of my favorite charts is called What's My Motivation? And, you know, it's kind of snidely. I think it's made by Jeff Rientz, and he kind of... Riley says, oh, it's for that jerk who says, well, why are we even here? All right, let's roll on this chart and find out.
Right, right, Right. I like it. And I will say one of the major, so before I started writing my own house rules, one of the major things that I use is the critical hits chart from Dragon 39, which is, you know, a big set of charts, and it takes up two pages in Dragon. That's the one of the three things in my DM screen. I like once a couple times a session having this really highly unusual, specific, horrible injury, I think gives some flavor. And again, one of my players asked a couple weeks ago, like, so is that the critical hits? That's part of original D&D? And I go, no, that's actually the one thing that Gygax really loathed. He really hated that. I think that's an add-on table that I use myself that I think adds to the game.
Another one of my favorites also comes from Rience. There's What Are the Goblins Doing? I use that one a lot.
Yeah, that's nice. And I have my own little minimized version of that on a
really?
D6. Actually, yes, I do now. Actually, so I actually think that's a good idea.
I'm also thinking of a one page dungeon that I love to run, that is called something. Oh, geez, now the name has slipped my brain. But one page dungeon, and they devote, I don't know, 10-15% of the bottom of a page to a random chart, because there's a room, or there's a series of caverns in it that are full of mushrooms, and here's a chart of what happens if you eat the mushrooms.
Right. Right.
And it's hilarious. It's great.
Right.
Oh, I wish I could remember the name of that thing. I'll look it up. I'll find out.
There is a random mushroom eating table in, I think, the next room that my players are going to go into, probably. So it's well advised.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
To have a random mushroom table. Whenever I was the judge to the one page dungeon contest, I think 2014. That's pretty common. There's a lot of randomy tables and a lot of one page dungeons.
It's gutsy, I think, to devote that much of your real estate, because you've one page. It's not a lot of space. Devote a bunch to some tables.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think that would ever hit me as like super unusual, actually. I'm thinking of there was one that was like a space adventure that was similar to that, of like every time you took off, I think you'd land on a random one of seven planets or something like that. I think that's probably old schooly. I mean, it's probably old schooly, and it's interesting that it's, you know, it comes off as kind of improv-y, is that you're gonna riff on this unexpected event.
Yep.
And of course, historically, there's a phase where people really hate wandering monsters. Is like, this isn't part of the plot. How dare you have random wandering monsters cluttering up your plot? I think there's a lot of reasons why you do want that.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I feel like charts, perhaps, are considered a hallmark of old school simply because they're easy to spot. Right now, what we're really getting at is that they feed that mentality of improvisation, of there being gaps and you have to fill them in and make it up. But sort of like, you know, faded blue maps, right?
Yeah.
It feels old school. It looks old school. Is it necessarily old school? Well, it's possible, I think, to do it in a way that's not.
That's a really good point. And also something like a box text. Right. So if I look at a publication, there's boxed entry text. To me, that immediately says not old school.
Right. Well, that's interesting, right? Because it's such a visual indicator of old.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe not old school, but old.
Right. Well, I have this thesis, right, whereby the pictures are powerful to the extent that they actually are going to overwrite what you've got written in the text. You have to be careful that if you have any kind of contradiction between your text and the picture always wins. People remember the picture and not the not the text.
Yep.
And somewhere on my blog, I have like three classic examples of contradictions between text and picture. I think one of them being reaction table. Like an original D&D, the text says monsters always attack you and pursue. And then there's this table that says, in the unusual circumstance when there's an intelligent monster that knows not to attack a larger party, roll on this table. And everybody always remembers, like, you got to roll on the reaction table every time you meet monsters.
Right.
And they ignore what the original text said. Yeah, so the imagery is like really super powerful, and you have to watch out you don't accidentally signal something different than what you initially meant.
Yeah. So I think coming soon to my blog, a post that I've been sort of brewing in the back of my head, as we've been thinking about what is old school, and specifically, in my case, specifically thinking about that beginning but no ending. My dear friend Adam, as we were driving down from Carnage on the Mountain, which is a local convention up here, was asking me as we were listening to the podcast, and that concept came up. He said, "Well, what about your horror games? Are they old school?"
Right.
So I've recently been dabbling in. I think of them as Cthulhu, but they're not Cthulhu because they have nothing to do with the mythos and they don't use the rule set. So right. Now I'm trying to change my branding to just call them horror games. They're horror games. Don't worry about it.
Great.
And they're all written custom by me. And so I was thinking, well, I certainly didn't set out to make them old school, but did I make them old school unconsciously?
Okay.
Where
are you on that now?
What's that?
Where are you on that now?
I think it actually depends on the adventure. I think that there's one that I can point out that is decidedly old school because it lays out a bunch of characters. It does give them some early motivations, hooks into why they care. Now, in these games, I run them at conventions, so they're pre-gens, so I'm not, you know, so I know who the characters are.
Right.
And I have a bunch of locations that they're going to visit, and that's the entirety of the text.
Right. So is that the Zulu game, or is that...
That's actually Mazes and Monsters.
Okay, great.
Mazes and Monsters has rolled out fairly differently every time I've played it. Players go to different locations just because they're motivated to do so.
Yeah.
Is there an ending? I mean, eventually they most of them die or go insane.
But there's not an ending written in your notes or text.
Correct. Yeah. Now, Checkpoint Zulu, the other one, which is based in Berlin in the 1980s, has got a little espionage element. There is a climax scene that will inevitably happen.
Okay, crazy.
Is that an ending? Maybe. It certainly usually happens in the last half hour of play.
Yeah.
There's not much game after it.
Okay. Is it an event that automatically happens, or is it a place that they have to get to?
It doesn't... Well, let's see. Does it automatically happen in the recent... editions of writing it, I have started to write in like a look, if the players just go completely off script and do whatever the hell they want, then this other group will trigger this event and it will ultimately happen.
Right.
So I think it is an event that will inevitably happen. Probably, and in fact, every playtest I've ever run, the players trigger it.
Okay.
So very likely that's what's going to happen. But I do have a contingency of like, here's how it'll happen if not. I guess maybe that's a good point. Now I'm even questioning, why do I have that? Maybe I should just edit that right out.
I mean, you know, so I mean, it feels, you know, newer school to me to have that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm not dogmatic enough to say that only old school games are good. Right. Mm-hmm. So if that's a good game, it can be a good, not old school game. That's 100% fine.
Well, and that's why it's so interesting for me to look at those particular games, because I wasn't thinking of old school and I wasn't thinking these are old school games when I sat down to write them. I thought these are horror games.
Right.
And I'm going to write what I think makes a good horror game.
Right.
And I never really bothered to think about old school versus new school.
And I'll also say that, you know, it's easy, you know, like the old school places being explored, exploration, open world, right? It's easier to do in a home campaign game where you kind of have an open-ended amount of time. And when you switch to a tournament or convention game, you know, for a number of years, I was frankly making an error about trying to recreate dungeon crawl exploration stuff in a convention, and it wasn't working super well. And so now I realize that, like, in a convention situation, you probably do have to strip out the wandering monsters. And if you do have a more linear, you know, here's the start, this is the only time we're going to play it. Here's a satisfying conclusion. I do think that's probably more, arguably useful in a limited one-off convention setting, which is what you're doing a lot at the moment, like with these games you're talking about.
Certainly, I'll preface this with I've never run a horror campaign. I've only ever run them as
style games. Right. Right.
But certainly, the demands of convention versus campaign are very different. That's probably a whole separate stream we should spend talking
about.
That's
a great point. Yes. Great point.
But yeah, I think, you talk about cutting out Wandering Monsters. I think it really comes down to just like pacing is so important. You have this one window of time with these players. Right. Do what you got to do to make the good stuff hit the table in the 4 hours you have.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sometimes I'm a slow learner, but I agree with that now. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. Well, let's wrap it up, I guess.
I agree.
Final thoughts on what is or is not old school.
Yeah. So what did I hit there? So high death count, short written material, short rules, possibly little or no backstory, possibly no names even. Mm-hmm. But the first couple of things that hit me like that.
Yeah, I would add to that, I guess, heavy reliance on improvisation, right? Gaps, yeah. However you need to create them such that there's room for interpretation at the table.
Yeah.
Those feel very old school to me.
Yeah.
And I would say publishing date doesn't matter.
That's fine. I'm hip to that. Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Great. Well, I'd say that was a great talk, Dan. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for setting this up and handling the technical side of things. This was awesome.
Absolutely. We will, I'm sure, have more discussions like this, and you will see us posting the schedule for that online as they come through.
Sounds good.
So thanks, everyone, for joining us. See you later.